Hello, I'm Ben Cohn, and today I'd like to present some ideas we've been thinking about regarding a comprehensive framework for hydrocephalus. As you can tell by the title, we seek to introduce a mechanics-based framework to ultimately improve diagnosis and treatment of hydrocephalus based on collected clinical data. Professor Ray and I have been in contact with Dr. Egnor and Professor Wagshaw at Stony Brook regarding this approach. Abe Voorhees and Soren Vidal helped with the ventricular dilatation measurements. I'd like to thank them all for their help and all of you for your attention. We seek to develop a simple and accurate, but rigorous and robust, mechanics-based paradigm for the diagnosis and treatment of hydrocephalus. In order for us to even think about doing this, we need to be in partnership with neurosurgeons and MR physicists. So the objective of this talk is more about the dialogue leading to partnership than it is about specific research results. What I'd like to present today is how we would approach hydrocephalus from a traditional fluid mechanics perspective. The specific framework we're suggesting is an introductory undergraduate formulation called integral control volume analysis. The method entails defining regions or control volumes in the brain. In these volumes, accounting balances are used to monitor the properties of interest. The key point being, terms in the balance equations for mass and force conservation will be obtained directly from experiment. I'll spend the first part of this talk presenting the control volume approach, and the second part presenting thoughts and methodologies for implementing this. As a way of introducing the control volume approach, let me open with an analogy of a rancher and their pasture. I know it's not the brain, but we feel this is the best way to make these ideas accessible. Understanding the concepts in this analogy will really help when I discuss the actual control volume formulation. This is an aerial photo of a ranch. The blue lines represent fences. The rancher has chosen where to put these fences. These fences are analogous to the control volume boundaries. If the rancher had different needs, then he or she would arrange the fences differently. These fences, depending on what the rancher is interested in, for example, the total number of cows on the ranch, or how many cows are in each corral, the rancher can use the corrals as a method of tracking them. The rancher is working within a cow budget. The rancher's accounting works as follows. The rancher knows how many cows are in a given corral to start with. He or she then counts the number which enter and exit the corral through the gates. If the cows are born and die inside the corral, and they are also counted, the final number of cows in the corral is then naturally found. The rancher is working within a cow budget. Every cow need not be watched at all times. Only the cows which enter and exit through the corral's gates and the cows which are born and die need to be taken into account. This accounting approach can be likened to applying the fundamental conservation principles to control volumes consisting of the intracranial fluid spaces. This is a schematic of the brain showing the CSF spaces, excluding the subarachnoid space. We have arbitrarily outlined the ventricles because they are likely candidates for control volumes. The blue lines represent the control surfaces, which are the boundaries of the individual control volumes. Clinicians want to monitor certain parameters in hydrocephalus, just as the rancher tracks his cows. Within the brain, if we are interested in tracking a certain property, we must measure the flow of that property across the control volume's boundaries and the amount of that property in the control volume. The advantage is then, just as the rancher only needs to count the cows which go in and out through the corral's gates, the births and deaths, and the total number of cows in the corral, for hydrocephalus, we only need to know the fluid velocity and pressure at passages crossing the control surface and the mass and momentum content of the control volumes. In control volume analysis, we don't require full velocity and pressure field information throughout the cranium, only at key points along the surface of the control volumes. The key to the framework is then choosing the proper corral or control volume, which will allow the maximum amount of terms in the conservation equations to be evaluated directly from measurements, while still producing physically meaningful results. This is only possible through a multidisciplinary collaboration. Being based on rigorous scientific method, there are obviously mathematical equations involved. However, the intention here is not to be overly detailed, but simply to describe the physical meaning of terms in the equation which guide the clinical measurements. The first equation represents conservation of mass, which is simply a mass budget. Thinking of a control volume as a container, the amount of fluid in that container can change with time. It could change because of fluid flowing in or out of the container, Or in the case of CSF, production or absorption can also change the amount of mass in the container. This is, in simple terms, mass conservation for a control volume. The first term represents the change in mass in the control volume. The second term represents the flow of mass in and out of the control volume. And the third term represents the production and or absorption contribution to the mass change within the control volume. This equation represents a system for the balance for the system mass, which must be satisfied at all times. The second equation is an alternate form of Newton's second law, F equals ma. Here we recognize a force balance on the container or control volume. Forces due to pressure and shear stress act on the boundary, while body forces such as gravity act on the fluid bulk. In addition, there is a force caused by fluid flow in and out of the container. To understand how this force arises, consider that the end of a hose must be physically restrained to keep it from whipping about. That it must be held is a consequence of the force created by fluid flowing out of the hose. These forces are balanced by the change in momentum, which is the ma part of Newton's second law, and represented by the first term in the equation. The other four terms are the forces, in order the force due to fluid flow, the force due to pressure, the force caused by shear stress, and the body force are shown in their mathematical forms. This equation represents a balance for the system momentum. Once again, these are the conservation equations. They are not a mathematical model. They are exact statements of mass and force conservation applicable to any control volume. Modelers will start with these or similar equations, such as Navier-Stokes, and will give simpler mathematical forms to the terms in order to arrive at a solution. Here, as experimentalists, we ask, can we evaluate the terms in the conservation equations directly from experiment? In these equations, each of the eight terms has a distinct physical meaning, but there are at most only three primitive variables, the velocity, pressure, and volume change. With information regarding these variables, all the terms in the equation will be known and solvable. It is important to note that in this formulation, I don't need to know the primitive variables everywhere in the flow at all times, just at critical locations, where at inlets and outlets to the control volume. As an example of how this formulation could be used, consider the CSF in the third ventricle to be the container in which properties of interest are monitored. Once the control volume is defined and the equations are written, the primitive variables are measured to evaluate the mass and force balances. Velocity and pressure are measured at key locations where fluid flows through the control volume boundaries. In the third ventricle, this occurs at the foramina to the lateral ventricles and at the aqueduct. These locations are marked by arrows in the figure. These measurements, in addition to volume change measurements, are all that is needed to evaluate the conservation equations fully. The body force is known as long as the volume and the acceleration is known and the acceleration and gravity are specified. So we see, the control volume framework only necessitates measurements of velocity and pressure at key locations on the control volume surface and volume change measurements. I'd like to point out now that blood as well as CSF spaces can be studied using the control volumes. In fact, making control volumes for both allows coupling to be studied, which is an extremely important part of intracranial dynamics. And as just discussed, the most important measurements are those of fluid velocity and pressure at key locations on the control volume surface and the volume changes of the fluid spaces of interest. I would like to discuss how these measurements can be made, particularly the volume change estimation technique developed in lab. I'm sure most of you are familiar with measurements taken using velocity-encoded MR imaging. Several investigators have used this technique to measure velocities throughout the cardiac cycle. Both blood and CSF velocities can be measured at many sites in the cranium using this technique. For the control volume approach, we will need measurements such as these. Other investigators have measured pressure within the brain and fluid spaces of the cranium. Pressure measurements will need to be taken at the flow passages crossing control volume boundaries. Thus, control volumes can be defined based on where pressure can be measured currently, or if technique improvements allow pressure to be measured at any anatomical site, then control volumes can be based on more physical or clinical reasoning. A technique called digital particle image velocimetry is used in our lab to measure 2D fluid flow velocity fields from intensity changes between images. This technique is sensitive enough to track the displacement of the ventricle's walls. This allows the volume change and hence the mass change to be estimated. Digital Particle Image Velocimetry, or DPIV, was first introduced to quantify complex fluid motion. Traditional DPIV experiments consist of fluid seeded with particles. The particles scatter light from the laser sheet towards the camera. The resulting images contain the particle's speckle pattern. The motion of this pattern between successive frames is tracked digitally, and then the velocity field can be found. Here we see an example of the particle speckle pattern recorded by the camera. The program tracks intensity variations within small windows of the image, denoted by the red square. The program tries to determine where in the new image the old window was displaced to. In the subsequent image, features in the window are displaced up and to the left, so the particles initially in the red box move to the location of the gray box. Doing this for many windows all over the image gives an entire grid of velocity vectors. This is a movie of the experimentally measured fluid velocity and vorticity fields of flow around a cylinder. The grid of vectors was found as just described, each frame being created from an image pair. This is one of the earlier uses of DPIV in our lab, as it is a classic problem in fluid mechanics. More recently, our lab has been applying DPIV to biofluid dynamics of many different flows and at many scales. The next few slides are meant to introduce some of the many uses of DPIV in our lab. Here, DPIV is being used to measure pulsatile flow within an in vitro bypass graft model. Velocity vectors are colored on vorticity in this movie, which is a measure of fluid rotation. In this movie, blood cells flow through the capillaries of rats. The DPIV program is used to determine the velocity of the blood cells. The DPIV processing program has even been used to measure flow over cultured endothelial cells. The purpose here is to measure the stresses on the cells caused by the flow. You may know Megan Gendrick as Megan Kwan, the 2000 Olympic gold medalist in both the 100-meter breaststroke and 4x100-meter team relay. In this video of Megan's breaststroke, DPIV-derived velocity vectors are superimposed on the images used to obtain this information. These movies are used to help improve the performance of some of America's best swimmers. Once flow around human swimmers were performed, we asked, can we do the same for flow around marine mammals? Here, the flow around a dolphin is measured. After being directed by his trainer, Primo swims to the right. Again, the grid of vectors was obtained using the DPIV program. The goal here is to understand some of the best swimmers on Earth. A more familiar picture. Having used the DPIV program in many diverse arenas, its extension to measure the pulsatile volume change of the ventricles seemed reasonable. This is done by finding the displacement of the ventricles walls in MR images using the DPIV program. Here, I play two movies taken at different sagittal planes. The lateral ventricles walls are lined with arrows, which represent displacement vectors. The colors signify the magnitude of the wall normal displacement. Movies loop the 16 displacement vector fields obtained throughout the cardiac cycle. The displacement vectors are used to determine area changes, which can be translated into volume changes by summing over multiple slices. Yep. It's segmented just by zooming in and clicking with your mouse. There's about 100 points, and then spline interpolation. Smooth it out. Oh, absolutely. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't see them. they'd be really small. They're less than a pixel, maybe half a pixel.
Right. So the data, error resolution is going
to be pretty. Yeah, I think that's true in any measurement technique using MR images. You're always limited by resolution. The DPIV program itself has, there's many papers on it, has been shown to have within, they say, 0.02 of a pixel resolution in measuring displacement.
But what is a pixel in terms of millimeters or microns?
You have to ask Mark, he took this image. So say it was a tenth of a hundredth of that, yes. On an order, a hundredth of half a millimeter.
How do you determine the segment, the border between the CSF and the
This is displacement. Yes. See, the way the DPIV program... I think I could tell you how it works since I know how the DPIV program works.
Okay.
So, remember how I just showed, and you get a grid of vectors, right? And now, if I wanted to outline a ventricle, I would outline a ventricle here, and then I'd get points on that line. Then what you do is you interpolate this square grid of vectors to those points. You could also know the normal, you know, the outward normal of that region, and then you could get the wall normal displacement, and that's, you integrate that around to get the area change. How you get subpixel accuracy is that by looking at those windows, instead of looking at individual particles, you move this window around, and you can move it, and then you fit a smoother function to it, and you look at the max in that function, and that gives you the subpixel accuracy. It's not a discrete, this is a planar technique because you basically have two images and you see how they change, so it's planar, everything's 2D here. So these vectors aren't coming out of the board, they're actually on the pixel, they're not sticking out at you, or in.
Most of the motion is like this. The whole ventricle
movement. It is up and down.
Most of it is up and down. The whole ventricle movement is not squeezing. Most of the motion is actually...
Yeah, I think that's what we're seeing, too. It's mostly the brain moving up and down. But you're going to pick that up, and then you'd have... When you integrate around, those differences come out, though.
Is that also saying that the frontal horns are displaced more than the temporal horns?
The colors are based on the wall normal displacement, which means that red means that it's going to expand the ventricular space, and here we have blue. That means it's actually going to contract into the ventricular space. Red would basically be an expansion, and blue would be a contraction. It has to do with the alignment of the displacement with respect to the wall normal. It's the dot product. Yeah.
Trying different mappings of your grid onto the data, and you get different measurement at different positions, moving the grid all in the same size.
We interpolate from the rectangular grid onto the ventricle's walls. How you get some pixel accuracy, and this would probably only be from the rectangular grid, not here. These are already been interpolated, so the subpixel accuracy is in the square grid of vectors. How you do that is you can move this box only integer number of pixels, right? You can't put it at half a pixel. You can't move it half a pixel. You have to move it integer numbers. But you do that for move it around a lot and say, how good does this look compared to where, you know, compared to that first box? And you get a function, basically, a two-dimensional function, right, of how good it is at all these different places. And you fit that with a smooth Gaussian function, and whatever that's maximum, that is how you get subpixel accuracy. There are numbers to all of this. We haven't really looked into that yet, but I don't know what to do with it. The volume change, if you look at it, are mostly pretty much sinusoidal-esque. I don't know the time. You'd have to talk to Mark about this stuff. We just process and send it back to him, so. Yes?
Question.
Sure.
The control volume theory that you outlined, does it not depend on the various enclosures, the ranchers' pens, having rigid, unchanging fences, and since the particular walls expand and contract over various cardiac and respiratory cycles, can we really make that analogy? And for example, if we were increasing the concentration of cows in a pen, but a pen got larger, even if there were any number of cows, the concentration would go down.
You don't know how happy I am you brought that up. Because the rancher's analogy is an analogy, and no analogy is perfect. So our point is, let's get away from analogies. I was just using it to describe how this approach would be used. Control volumes can do anything you want. They can change size, shape, but once you fix and say, like, for instance, that third ventricle, that control volume is going to change size, no doubt. I mean, it's going to change size. Fluid's going to flow in, if you know, and it'll change size, and that's fine. We're going to measure that volume change. And so the point is, in the control volume, even if it can change size, you could still have it change and volume flow and mass flow through at the same time.
Then you're not just measuring properties at the transition point. You're measuring the property of the compartment itself, like its volume.
We're going to measure the volume change, the velocity, where fluid flows in and out, and the pressure at those same places. That'd be the minimal best. If we could make more measurements, then we would do even better. But for right now, you know that we're limited by measurements. Everybody knows that. We don't, to be honest with you, I have no idea how this is going to end up working out. We need to work with people who measure pressure, because we don't do it. And plus, no one's going to let me go anywhere near their brain. So, that's why this is the sales pitch for someone to work with us. Is any more questions now? I could go on, or I'll just go on. Thank you, though. Those were very...
Well, I'm sorry. No. Possible to do the same visual thing simultaneously with a section of the cortical subarachnoid space. So you could see what was happening with the brain itself as it as the difference between those two.
We maybe don't have that capability yet, but I don't see a reason why that couldn't happen. Well, it's fully 3D. I mean,
it was just a small segment of it. You've got down the whole ventricle. There's no reason you'd have to do the whole course of subarachnoid space. Just the area right across the brain from that. It would be quite interesting to see whether they're going like this.
Oh, okay.
Like that.
Oh, I see. Okay. We could certainly do that. I mean, so we have there's an entire square grid of vectors for this image, but we only show the ones that have been interpolated. I still have a couple slides. Oh. Thank you, though. Those were very good points. So the principal benefits of using the control volume budgets is the ability to link diverse clinical measurements in a sound theoretical framework. This is so because the technique is applied directly to the volumes of interest. This approach is precise because it works directly from mass conservation and Newton's second law in forms which are directly applicable to the defined volumes. Physically meaningful results are obtained by utilizing the precise physics without depending on analogies, allowing direct evaluation and interpretation of the results. This method is simple and direct in that it distills out critical parameters and interactions for examination. Most importantly, this approach requires no direct simplifications or assumptions, as the framework is directly applicable to the defined volumes, as stated previously. These advantages result naturally from this most basic analysis. I would like to quickly review how this method would work. First and foremost, the system of interest, the intracranial space, must be split up and divided into any desired number and arrangement of control volumes. Each can be thought of as a black box, but not in the traditional modeling sense. Once the volumes are chosen, the conservation equations are written for each. Then measurements are taken reflecting the physical meanings of terms in these equations. These measurements and equations together are used to monitor what happens at the control volume surface, net changes within the control volume, and coupling between different control volumes. The control volume formulation is well suited for studying complex systems where comprehensive detailed data is unavailable or unnecessary. I hope the difference between control volume analysis and traditional modeling has been fully articulated. The basic control volumes equations are solved directly from experimental measurements. This express connection between the measurements, terms in the conservation equations, and the actual physical regions will result in improved understanding of intracranial dynamics, including coupling. It also provides a rigorous framework to combine diverse clinical data sets properly. In order for us to become partners within the hydrocephalus research community, we seek feedback regarding implementation of the control volume approach to hydrocephalus and affirmation that indeed this technique is useful. In essence, this will be achieved through a multidisciplinary collaboration with established members of this community. Through this collaboration, the desired number and arrangement of control volumes will be defined. The control surface must be chosen in a judicious fashion because measurements must be taken at the control volume's boundaries. The volume will be dictated by what measurements are possible currently. If measurements improve and can be measured at many more sites, then control volumes can be based on more clinical reasoning. Once the volume has been defined, conservation equations are written. The data must be collected, guided by physical meaning of terms in these equations. We seek to work with people who can make the desired measurements. I hope it is clear that there is a need for the collaboration of the implementation for control volumes to hydrocephalus. Our expertise in experimental fluid mechanics needs to be augmented with knowledge of physiology, hydrocephalus, and the required measurement techniques. And now I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you may have regarding this framework. Thank you.
Quick question?
Sure. And